touch me in the pouring rain. And the moment that you wander far from me, I want to feel you in my arms again. And you come to me on a summer breeze, keep me warm in your love, then you softly leave. And it's me you need to share. Happy day. This is Freya's day. Freddy. Yeah, She-Wolf Day in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. And that was a request from one of our people out there. And that was the BJs, the Bee Gees. They sing those sweet songs for the ladies. And maybe the guys. Wait a minute, what's going on here? Okay, It's March the 27th, 2015. Like I said, Friday, Freya's Day, in the bunker, Ladies' Day. Well, it's in the 30s today, low 30s. Wow, spitting a little bit of snow again. We still don't have spring back here in northern Indiana at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And like I say, it's Freya's Day. You know, there's a lot of racial right-wing radio stations and people sending out all kinds of stuff. I notice that most of them are, they just want to send you the pictures of niggers fighting and all each other and all that kind of stuff. And I do that a little bit too, but I think there's not much education going on most of these stations. Oh yeah, they badmouth the Jews, badmouth the Mexicans and the blacks, and I do too. But I don't hear much education going on about things you need to know. And that bothers me because I think it's not all accidental with newbie people. I think it's a definite false flag to corner the right-wing racialists into a very tight, identifiable bunch of people. Not only to be dumb about things that they need to be smart about, but to know right where they're at when they need to, if they need to pick them up. I notice I'm getting more and more of this kind of stuff. So anyhow, I'm not going to go into it big time. But you got to get education along with it. Because if you're not educated to the subject of all kinds of things for self-defense and everything like that, psychological self-defense, you're not going to be ready for what you may have to put up with as time goes on. Now, some people question my sanity for putting on a lot of MikeMalloy.com's material because he's a progressive, a liberal progressive. But he's a rogue type, and he researches a lot of stuff and puts stuff together that nobody has that kind of time to do, or very few people do. So I take the good stuff he puts out, the stuff that I think benefits us and our education, and we leave his views on race and even homosexuality with him. And a lot of right-wingers, they either don't want to understand that or will not understand that. Every once in a while I get an email, "My God, that guy's a horrible race-fixing guy," or "this guy, you printed material from, why, you even talked about Karl Marx in a somewhat positive way." I'm telling you, you got to get a lot smarter to get ahead of these people, and you got to find the information where you find it. And once you've digested it, and if you don't agree with it, well, say something about it. But I've moved into a new particular area. In fact, I've been doing it for years, but nobody much notices. I'm not a right winger. I'm not a right winger. Don't include me into the right wing. And I'm going to take a lot of the things that the progressives and the left and the liberals say that I agree with, now that I've evolved myself down through time, out of the John Birch Society and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, it's a new day, and you're going to have to be on the ball. Racially, of course, the liberals are, progressives are terrible on the race issue. In fact, they're terribly counterproductive. But on other issues, they can be dead right and make a lot of sense, and make a lot more sense than the neocons. And if you still think you're a right-winger, the way these right-wingers salivate for the Jews in Israel, Hannity and all those kind of guys, and all those talk show guys on the right, so-called conservatives, they're not conservatives. There hasn't been many real conservatives around for decades. That's why they call these people neocons. I'd call them neo-nincompoops. Because they're shoveling you half shit and half sugar. And that's not a very good, not very appetizing and not very beneficial to your health. But any of these guys that go off on anybody that says anything critical of Jews or blacks or anything else, and automatically cuts you off the phone and calls you a Nazi, and, well, don't buy their stuff. Don't buy their stuff. But anyhow, I'm going to do what I'm going to do as a lone wolf, and hopefully there's enough people out there so far that understand that and are going to go along with it. Otherwise, it gets very boring tuning into these quasi-racist radio programs that just keep going on and on and on about the same old thing. Now, I'm going to go to education today, and we're going to go back to the book, The Man Called Lucy, the man that almost single-handedly with he recruited 10 high-ranking military officers in the German high command. He had whoever was sending him stuff out of the high command had access to the telexes, and you would have had to be extremely high up with plenty of credentials to do that. And so him and his boys, I think, can be credited with bringing down the Third Reich, or at least doing a hell of a lot towards bringing down the Third Reich. So Mr. Roessler was his name. So let's get back into the book. Meanwhile, back at Maybank camp at Zozen, only a few miles away from the SD headquarters, Rudolf Roessler's companions had no notion that the most formidable espionage organization in the Reich was about to begin its attempts to localize the intelligence leak. They had little reason to fear, for they took every possible precaution. As soon as a piece of intelligence of significant importance reached them, they coded it and waited for a suitable time at night when the traffic was at its most intense to transmit it. No listening station could distinguish this single transmission among the thousands of coded radio telegrams crowding the atmosphere, and this message could be decoded only in Lucerne. In Lucerne, Roessler had not yet learned that Stalin's sudden blind trust in Lucy had caused a strategic catastrophe, the loss of Kiev, Ukraine. The center made no reproaches. The affair would simply find its way through the profits and losses account. The Germans would pay for it later with interest. The only urgent request for intelligence to come from Moscow concerning the German units on the Eastern Front, their manpower, their armament, their destinations. Roessler transmitted these requests to Berlin, and the replies came back, usually within 48 hours. At the beginning of autumn 1941, he was even to pass on to the Russians two surprising items of scientific information. The Germans were putting the final touches to a new weapon, which had been called the V-1. They had also begun the construction of a 10-ton rocket. This was one of the last messages Alexander Foote would transmit before an incident occurred that caused considerable concern to Roessler and his friends in the OKW. On October 19, 1941, a Sunday night, the operator at the center in Moscow had been transmitting a dispatch that had lasted about a half an hour involving requests for details on the activities of the Wehrmacht. Suddenly, the Morse stopped dead. Foote made two or three calls, but there was no reply. The next day, he tried again and again the day after that, but he was met by silence. He warned Radow and Schneider, telephoned to Roessler. No one knew what was going on. For the next 6 weeks, Roessler communicated his information only to his Swiss employers in the Bureau of HA. In Berlin, his friends became angry. The Swiss weren't fighting the Nazis. Some other means of contacting the Russians had to be found. Every night, Foote tuned in his transmit a receiver to the center's wavelength and hope that something would come through. 17 days later, on Wednesday, November the 5th, 1941, Schellenberg was near Dresden, where the SD had just installed an important new listening station. Now, this is what I dug up and given out to you people quite some time ago. In fact, it's been 2 or 3 years now that everybody's saying, well, Dresden was an open city. Dresden was just civilians coming in from the east and all that kind of stuff, which was true, but it had no military value. Well, I dug up the information. It did have military value. And that was it was one of the biggest listening posts in the world. Receivers listening to about every frequency imaginable to man. And so it was very strategically important to the Third Reich. So that was a reason. And here he's telling in this book about their equipment there in Dresden and their center. And I've never heard any right winger, any conservative talk about this. They all want to just say, well, it's horrible that they firebombed Dresden. Well, of course it was. It's terrible to firebomb any city. But there was a reason. 17 days later, on Wednesday, November 5th, 1941, Schellenberg was near Dresden where the... Oh, I just read that. Germany's best decoders were engaged on work of vital importance at Dresden. Not a decimeter of wavelength escaped their attention 24 hours a day. But in the incredible crowded atmosphere, it was often impossible to distinguish those of the enemy among the mass of dots and dashes. And that's one thing all of you out there should do, is learn Morse code. It's not that hard to learn. Even when an enemy message had been located, it still did not yield up its secrets. It had to be worked on, often unsuccessfully. A, B never represented B, either for the Führer's headquarters, for the transmissions of the OKW, or for the enemy. Similarly, A, too, had no meaning in itself in this world of darkness. Sometimes when the keys, a code did not prove too difficult to break, as was the case of Die Rote Kapelle. For example, the experts in Dresden rejoiced, but their work was seldom that easy. George King, one time, who was the son of Admiral King, we were good friends, worked together on the West Coast. He's passed away quite some time ago. He showed me a nifty little code game that you could do with a deck of cards. And I forgot exactly how it went now, but... when you meet with someone, one of your compadres, you both have a deck of cards, and you make up this code with the cards. And you use that code until you think maybe it's been broken. But it involves just a card, stack of cards. And I was very impressed with that because it's so effective and so simple. I'm going to have to dig out the information on it. It wasn't difficult, but my memory, I forget things. Persevere, Schellenberg told him. One day you will find a series of suspicious signals in the atmosphere. Chance soon favored this enterprise. For 3 weeks, Schellenberg had been telephoning Dresden, anxiously hoping for news. On November 28th, the listening station informed him that on several successive nights, they had made out a very brief message, repeated several times on 43 meters. On each occasion, it had begun at exactly the same time, 1 a.m. The message was always identical. NDA, FRX, NDA, FRX, NDA, FRX. it's not too soon or too late for you people out there to get involved with that kind of stuff. With shortwave ham transmitters and so forth that you can play around with. What do you think it is? Schellenberg asked. Difficult to say, though its brevity and repetition of the signal indicates that it may be a call signal. Where is it coming from? It never lasts long enough for us to find out. We've no sooner got the Genio into position than the transmission stops. Keep trying. Paradoxically, perseverance was a quality shared by both Schellenberg and Rossler, as it is by all the best secret agents. The signal was, of course, that of Alexander Foote vainly calling the center during the break in contact. That Dresden had heard it was not in itself as serious as it might at first seem, for following a principle practiced by all the clandestine operators, neither Rado's network nor their opposite numbers in Moscow ever used the same wavelength for both their messages and their call signals. Moreover, they used an additional camouflage. Foote called on 43 meters, then tuned into 39 meters, as previously agreed with the center. As soon as the center had replied on 39 meters, Foote stopped using 43 meters. He would then communicate on the same wavelength as his Moscow colleague. These wavelengths were frequently changed to avoid establishing a pattern that could be picked up by a listening station. And the same thing, they still do this kind of stuff too on shortwave. There's a lot of mysterious signals floating around on shortwave. Such a ruse could not possibly continue to confuse specialists armed with the latest equipment. Dresden was well aware of the trick. They enlarged the area under observation using several receivers simultaneously tuned in to a range of neighboring wavelength. You see, this is what I told you. They had tremendous numbers of receivers and so forth at this center. Very critical to the success of the Third Reich. In order to limit the field in this atmospheric cacophony, they eliminated all transmissions whose sources they knew, even if they did not recognize the wavelengths being used. These included, of course, the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht and Hitler's own headquarters. Meticulously, they noted down thousands of enigmatic fragments, cataloging the incomprehensible, hoping that one day their rigorous classification of similar repetitions of letters and figures would afford a gleam of light. Meanwhile, as 1941 came to an end, events of the greatest importance were taking place. The United States had entered the war, and Japan had transformed it into a worldwide conflict by making a lightning attack on Pearl Harbor. Britain had stoically survived the Blitz. On the continent, the German army had just suffered its first setbacks in the east. Under pressure from General Zhukov at the head of 100 fresh divisions, the Wehrmacht was retreating before Moscow. Field Marshal von Kluge replaced von Bock as commander of the group of armies at the center, which had been unable to contain the T-34s of Maslakov and Koenig's divisions. Von Rundstedt had lost Rostov and been deprived of his command. A series of dismissals had shaken the Wehrmacht high command. Hitler had dismissed Guderian and Hoppner on Christmas Day and taken over the supreme command of the German armed forces himself. The renewal of the radio link between Alexander Foote and the center was unexpected as its rupture. Suddenly on Monday, December 1, 1941, the center resumed its transmissions. To Foote's great surprise, the Soviet operator continued to send precisely the same message he had been communicating when the interruption had occurred a month and a half earlier, as if these weeks of anxiety had never existed. At the end of the dispatch, Foote asked his unknown colleague the reason so prolonged for such a prolonged silence. It was quite simple. Following the German attack on Moscow, the authorities had feared that the Soviet capital might be taken or subjected to a long siege and had decided to evacuate immediately all the administrative services to Kabashev, the old city of Samara, now a port on the Volga. There had been no time to contact Switzerland to inform them of the move. The resumption of contact had calmed Roessler's fears. It was becoming increasingly tense for his friends in the OKW, and they had been getting impatient. The news coming to Berlin from the east showed, in fact, that if the Russians exploited the Wehrmacht's first defeat in full, Nazism might soon be defeated. Never more than at this moment did this tiny group of resistors have to struggle against their consciences. Every dispatch communicated by them to the Russians would help the Red Army to plunge into the living flesh of the enemy, German flesh. For the Soviet troops had at last recovered their nerve on all fronts, from the north to the south. In the Crimea, General Pushkin's troops were attacking those of Count von Spanek, Colonel von Kalitz, and General Himmer. On the Don, Tymenchko, Lopatkin, and Karakhnov had recaptured Rostov and the Red Ruhr, which had fallen into the hands of von Rundstedt. In the ice-bound regions before Moscow, the group of armies from the Central Front were continually being harassed by Zhukov, Kuznetsov, Belov, and Devator. At Staraya Russa, on the banks of Lake Ilmen in the north, the soldiers of the Morozov and Elmenko were taking their revenge for the terrible reverses they had previously suffered. A fantastic thrust westward was beginning across the 600-mile front as the Soviet tanks moved in after the retreating Germans. The Germans were in serious difficulty, still fighting in their threadbare summer uniforms in the temperature of minus 40 degrees. Snow got into their boots, turned to ice, froze their feet, resulting in amputations. So the Russians now swept down on the retreating Germans, white waves of men against a white background, for the Russians were admirably suited to this kind of warfare. They had been banking on winter. Wearing white coats and white fur hats, the Siberian troops were ski-borne, rifles, tanks, and guns were painted white. The infantry wore boots that were always two sizes too big, which meant their feet could be wrapped in rags, the famous red socks, and could swell without being painfully chafed. The cold together with the attacking spirit of the Russian soldier delivered a blow to the Wehrmacht from which it never fully recovered. The first complete figures for the German troops in Russia compiled by General Halder in the winter of 41 were alarming. A retreat of 60 to 180 miles. Worse, there were 202,500 killed, 725,000 wounded, 46,500 missing, and 112,500 frozen to death. A total number of 1,100,000 men, a third of all the troops engaged at the beginning of the campaign. The Wehrmacht tried vainly to improve its transportation of supplies by organizing a shuttle service between the great supply depots and the front. It launched raids deep into the Soviet-held territory. It motorized its troops as much as possible, but it had been irreparably weakened, and it was to be finally devoured by the steppes. Now remember, by this time, or long before this, Hitler knew that he could not win this war. He was well aware that he would not win the war, but yet he did not sue for peace. So over a million men, were casualties or dead in Russia for nothing. At the same time as General Halder, Rudolf Roessler was drawing up his own account. The early work of Werther and Olga had not borne much fruit. The Western Allies had refused to listen to the mass information that had been offered them with such generosity, but the effects of Lucy's ring intervention in the East had been overwhelming. If the West had only listened, Roessler speculated Hitler could have undoubtedly been beaten in 1940. The incredulity demonstrated first by Copenhagen and Oslo, then by The Hague and Brussels, and finally by London and Paris shows quite clearly that at the beginning of this monstrous war, the state of mind of the military high commands of the Western democracies had not really evolved since 1918. For them, spies were still rather shady characters, unworthy of trust, even when they offered their intelligence without hope of reward. As a result, these men had refused to see the signs of the coming Nazi cataclysm, and the millions of innocent people were to fall victim to their indifference. Strangely enough, even Stalin, who was very much more aware of the value of Secret Service than were the Western leaders, followed their example until the war had actually reached his frontiers. But the first months of the campaign showed that the Russians were quick to recover from their initial suspicion. In the conduct of their operations, they were continued to value the intelligence service at its true worth. Roessler, encouraged by the Russian attitude, continued to work for them without a moment's let-up. The German émigré had another reason for his decision. The Swiss, at least those of whom he dealt, the leading anti-Germans in the Confederation, the Bureau, H.A., Brigadier Roger Mason, and ultimately General Guisan himself, allowed him to continue his collaboration with Moscow and thus act as silent accomplices. So much for neutrality. With the entry into the war of the United States, they felt considerable sure of their ground. Their decision at the very beginning of the war to give tacit support to the Allies had been vindicated. By the winter of 1941-42, it had become obvious that Germany, a prisoner to Hitler, would be unable to extricate itself from the situation into which the Führer had plunged it. Intelligence reached them through Roessler, showing that the Swiss had how badly things were going inside the Reich. The grave defeats on the Russian front and the series of disgraces that had struck an entire leadership of the OKW had survived the hopes of the many conspirators who flourished within the Wehrmacht High Command. Hitler, in fact, had dismissed 35 generals December 1941 and January 42, without counting Field Marshals von Brobstich, von Rundstedt, von Bloch, von Loeb, and Field Marshal Walter von Reichenau, who had died of a blood clot, and General Ernst Udet of the Luftwaffe, who had committed suicide in November. With the return of these embittered officers to Berlin, the wind of revolt blew up once more. The abortive attempt on Hitler's life in January 20, 44 has been given a great deal of attention. In fact, it was merely the culmination of a line of earlier plots, all hatched by the same men, beginning in 1938. Those who in 1944 ended up shot or hung on butcher's hooks in the Plötzensee prison, or strangled with piano cord at Flossenbürg, or driven to suicide had previously tried no fewer than 15 times to eliminate the Führer. In fact, it was permanent, but really quite unserious conspiracy. It was destined to fail because it included too many people, and the entire army knew who they were. The Gestapo knew. Even Hitler himself knew. For when he finally lost his temper after July 20th plot and decided to retaliate, 7,000 people were arrested, 5,000 of whom were summarily executed. In the corridors of the OKW, the Association of Conspirators was irreverently known as the Barometer of Glory. It went down only when the affairs of the Wehrmacht chiefs were going badly. Similarly, a stroke of good luck in the field followed by a few judicious promotions by Hitler were enough to send the barometer soaring. Rudolf Rosler's 10 friends kept well away from this vast shifting mass of plotters in order to preserve intact their own far more destructive work. Indeed, though unaware of it, these plotters were helping Rosler's friends, for whom they provided a convenient distraction. This explains why the 10 men were so invulnerable within the Oberkommando. Alarmed by the evident leaks that were taking place within the permanent nest of intrigue, the SD and the Gestapo made innumerable inquiries into its organization, unfailingly discovering the but never for a moment suspecting the technicians, who were well known for their lack of interest in conspiracies. Thus, Werther and Olga always slipped through the nets that had been cast for them. Walter Schellenberg alone got perilously close to them, and if history had granted Nazism a few more months of survival, he might very well have caught them. Hold it, boys. You ever notice how these pages stick together? Especially on older books. Chapter 10. April 1942, the mud season on the Eastern Front, a brief time of respite for the troops. From the Crimea to the Baltic. On each side of the front, columns of new men and materials were arriving from the rear to reinforce the combatants. In Lucerne, Geneva, and Lausanne, Rosler, Radau, and Foote were working full speed because Werther and Olga were doing so too. Thus, on April 14th, Lucy transmitted to the center, now back in Moscow after the crisis of October 41, the latest decisions made by the Führer in his headquarters at Rostenburg. A Hitler who was already going gray, suffering from inexplicable fits of giddiness, and who seemed tormented by a veritable phobia about cold and snow. Hitler had obviously aged very quickly in the past few months, but his lust for conquest was as insatiable as ever. Now remember what we do know. We do know that he was being shot up with meth. We do know that Dr. Jacobson developed his formula in Berlin, but at a certain point the brown shirts were on to him, and for some reason he took off and got out of Germany. But he was supplying these drugs to Hitler's doctor. I forget his name at the moment. Rommel and his Africa Corps had won a great victory. His Desert Foxes had recaptured Derna and Benghazi in Cyrenaica and were preparing to take Tobruk and enter Egypt. The Führer hoped for even better things in Russia, nothing less than a decisive victory, or at least that is what he declared in his directive. See, by this time he was hopelessly hooked on this crap, drugs. Morel was his doctor, and he was shooting him up also with monkey glands and all kinds of shit. These 10 pages of the instructions were dispatched to the OKW, orders to be carried out, the December crisis having deprived him permanently of all confidence in his high command. He left his generals as little room for initiative as possible. He wanted to know everything and direct everything. All orders should go out from Rostenburg, then from Berlin. A marvelous piece of fortune for Werther, Olga, and Lucy. So they were getting absolutely every piece of information proceeding from Hitler was going directly to the spies, and they were sending it on to Russia and probably Britain too. Directive number 41 was a plan of attack on the Don and the Caucasus. There were two simultaneous assaults. The first, in a pincer movement on the Russian forces concentrated between Donetsk and the Don, which must be destroyed. The second, in a direct thrust toward the Caucasian oil fields. No sooner had the intelligence reached the center from Switzerland than Stalin began to get restless. He wanted details, more details. Roessler transmitted the request to Berlin on April 18th, and the reply came back. Setting out from Kursk, Orel, and Kharkov, half the group of armies in the south under Field Marshal von Bock would reach the Don, then follow a course to its great loop just before Stalingrad. The second half would attack from Stalino and the port of Taganrog, try to recapture Rostov, and then link up with the first arm of the pincer movement beyond the Don's convergence with the Donets. Finally, an army corps under Field Marshal List would have it as its objective the Caucasian hills and the Baku oil fields. The date of the opening of the offensive, then of the great attack, would be determined later. Completing his intelligence, Roessler added that the long front line, which would be conquered across the Don by the Wehrmacht, would then be defended by the non-German troops. There would be 52 foreign divisions, 27 Romanian, 13 Hungarian, 9 Italian, 2 Czechoslovak, and 1 Spanish. Field Marshal Keitel had been sent to the Balkans to raise troops for the crusade against Bolshevism. You see, it becomes a crusade against Bolshevism late in the deal. That's what I've told people. I said, you know, Hitler didn't call on all these other nations for troops early on. He waited till his ass was in big trouble, and then he said, oh, this is a European fight. We got to stop Bolshevism. Hitler himself had obtained the Italians and Spaniards. The gaps made during the terrible winter months had to be filled. Because the Romanians and Hungarians hated each other and were more likely to fight each other than the Russians, they would be separated by the 9 Italian divisions and 1 Spanish division. The German high command, Lucy added, was not relying too heavily on these reinforcements, being very doubtful of their military value. The reservations of the German generals and the generals were to prove only too well-founded. These legions were to snap, bearing most of the responsibility for the Axis defeat. But in April 1942, neither the Germans nor the Russians knew this. No more than Foote knew at the time that the listening station on the SD near Dresden was rapidly tracking down the location of his transmitter. In mid-April, Schellenberg received a lengthy report from his technicians. They had succeeded in recording a long series of mysterious dispatches. All came from the same hand, whose touch they were now able to recognize. Yeah, a lot of people don't know telegraphy and Morse code and all that kind of stuff don't realize that each operator has his own what we would call fist, and like spoken word, after you communicate with a certain person for a certain length of time with Morse code and the key and the dot dash, you can determine who it is. Pretty interesting. And they get very fast. These operators get very fast. I've seen people receiving code 50, 75 words a minute, lean back in their chair and yawn and maybe have a drink of coffee and catch up. That's how good some of these people were. They have succeeded in recording long series of mysterious dispatches, all coming from the same hand, whose touches they were now able to recognize. They were, however, still trying to decode them. The use of a series of 5 mixed letters and figures suggested they felt that the usual Soviet code systems, but it was too early as yet to make a positive decision on the matter. They were using all the tracking techniques at their command, but what they needed was time. One important factor had been discovered. The transmitter that sent out these messages almost every night, always at the same time, was situated on a very definite geographical line passing near Madrid, Saragossa, Toulouse, Lyon, Geneva, and Nuremberg. The strength of the broadcast indicated that the transmitter was probably not more than 600 miles away, which would exclude Spain. Systematically, it searched all the German territory crossed by this line, entrusting the southern part. Let's see here. The southern part to be listening post of Captain Frinsnik at Sigmaringen. Though they were aware that the operator using this clandestine post frequently changed wavelengths, moving from 20 to 50 meters, they had managed to draw up a table of his favorite frequencies. Events were to accelerate during the next 2 months. In North Africa, Rommel launched his first great attack on Tobruk. In the east, von Bloch was preparing to begin his offensive. D-Day had been fixed for May 18th, but Lucy informed the Russians in time. They had known the date since May 5th, at dawn on May 12th, 6 days before the scheduled German attack. Tomenchko began to cut the ground from under the feet of the Wehrmacht. The Russians had decided to isolate most of the troops posted in the south by means of a pincer movement from the north with 22 divisions, six of them being armored, and from the south with 60 divisions, including 14 armored divisions. He aimed to get to Kharkov. Opposite him was the German 6th Army under von Paulus, which was to bear the brunt of his attack, from which was later to be destroyed at Stalingrad. In 4 days, everything seemed over. Completely cut off, von Paulus was unable to prevent Tomenchko from getting within 12 miles of Kharkov. At last effort, the Russian marshal would seize the town that the Wehrmacht had organized as a depot to supply its troops during the planned offensive. Tomenchko had been supplied with intelligence that at Kharkov he would find huge compounds of food and ammunition, both of which he needed urgently. His furious breakthrough had used up most of his reserves, and his communication lines had been stretched beyond a reasonable limit. There was one thing that Rudolf Rösler was unable to communicate to the Russians, because it was not a piece of intelligence. In any case, the Russians knew it only too well. This was the German soldier's exceptional tenacity and resilience. The Red Storm had no sooner ended than von Bloch launched the Kleist group of armies. On May 18th, after Tomenchko's rear lines, on May 21st, in a sensational change of fortune, the Soviet attack force was broken. Half of their troops had been encircled and wiped out. The other half were in flight. They were 200,000 prisoners, and 2,000 guns and 1,000 tanks had been captured or destroyed. In the south, too, things were going badly for the Russians. Sevastopol was about to fall. Manstein and List were finding the roads to Stalingrad and the Caucasus wide open before them. Hitler was feeling triumphant. He had not been able to enter Moscow, but he now had an even more ambitious plan. He imagined Rommel occupying Egypt, then moving further east as far as the Persian Gulf. Rommel and List would link up to give him at least the Russian oil fields as well as those of the Arab world. He would then hold the whole world's fate in his hand. Without oil, no one would be able to resist him. In Berlin, Rudolf Rösler's friends were near despair. The rejoicing that reigned in the German capital and even within the OKW, because the gods of war were favoring the Nazis, once more disturbed them. Everything seemed lost. They had taken maximum risk to send Rösler a maximum of intelligence for the use of the Russians. Plans of attack, details of the composition of the armies, of the equipment and of supplies, always well in advance, but all that had not been enough. The Russians, too, had done their utmost, as demonstrated by the fury of their attacks, amount of equipment destroyed, and the number of their dead and even the prisoners left behind, but it had not been enough. The abhorred Nazi power stretched from the Atlantic to the boundaries of Central Asia, from the Arctic to the Nile. The swastika was hoisted over the entire Mediterranean. The 10 conspirators would have been even more despondent if they had known that the intense jubilation that was being felt by Walter Schellenberg. He had several reasons for rejoicing. The 10 conspirators would have been even more despondent if they had known of the intense jubilation then being felt by Walter Schellenberg. He had several reasons for rejoicing. First, Richard Heydrich, the only obstacle to his unbounded ambition, was dead. John Kubis and Joseph Gabi, two non-commissioned officers of the Free Czech Army parachuted into Czechoslovakia by the RAF, had hurled a bomb under Heydrich's Mercedes in Prague on May 29, 1942. He died on June 4th from infections in the wounds he had received. You know, with today's medicine, they could have saved him. Back in the day, gut shots were really bad. But the SD was not long without a leader. On June 6th, Heinrich Himmler, the head of the entire SS and number 3 in the Nazi hierarchy, summoned all the party departmental chiefs to the palace of the Wilhelmstrasse in Berlin. Standing before the body of Heydrich, laid out to rest, Himmler pointed to the young SS Brigade Führer. Quote, "I place Schellenberg at the head of the group, and the man lying there regarded him as worthy of the post and trained him for it. I, too, consider him to be capable of assuming the task that awaited him. Above all, he is incorruptible. His youth and the fact that he is not a long-standing member of the National Socialist Party should not prevent you two from adopting him. He is the youngest among us, and for that reason has a right to my special support. I say this clearly and in his presence, because it was your murdered chief's desire that nothing should stand in the way of his nomination, and I consider Schellenberg to be too intelligent to allow himself to become intoxicated by what I have just said. On the contrary, I hope it will encourage him to carry out all the more careful and attentively the tasks that will be assigned to him." He was also overjoyed at the progress in the inquiry entrusted to him by his late chief. It was going remarkably well. Before long, he might even be able to present Himmler with a valuable token of his thanks. The listening station at Sigmaringen had confirmed the research of the Dresden station. The general direction in which the clandestine transmitter was situated was definitely the Madrid-Nuremberg line, but they still did not know to what point these regular dispatches were being directed. With the help of the powerful mobile station based in Strasbourg, a more precise triangulation had indicated that the transmitter was in Switzerland. It was still impossible to say whether it was in Geneva or Lausanne, but it was certainly somewhere on the shore of Lake Leman. This was a discovery of some importance for Schellenberg. The one that followed a week later on June 18, 1942 was even a greater one. Well before the Second World War, Soviet espionage had begun to base their coding systems on sentences taken from books. The Germans knew this. Their unmasking of Die Rote Kapelle, for example, had confirmed it. Moreover, their own intelligence services were now using the same excellent method. It was natural, therefore, for the decoding division of the SD to direct its research along these lines when it began to analyze the piles of dispatches recorded in Dresden since the beginning of 1941. After 3 months of extensive work, the mathematical analysis section had succeeded in isolating a single obscure word among the mass of hieroglyphics. Eberhard. A great many specialists from different fields had been set to work on the mysterious word in hopes that it might suggest something to one of them. A bibliophile finally resolved the puzzle. Everhard might refer to the name of one of the heroes of Jack London, the American writer of adventure stories, in particular to the hero of The Iron Heel, a political book written in 1907, one that I've advocated for years that everybody read. At last, a key to code had been found, with considerable difficulty since the book was banned in Germany. A copy was ultimately unearthed in a library in Bavaria. Unfortunately, it only served to decipher a certain number of the messages. The rest remained strictly incomprehensible, as if the code had been changed in the meantime. Now, the Germans realized how admirable this operator protected himself. Not only did he constantly change the wavelengths on which he transmitted his messages, but just as frequently shifted his codes. An incredible amount of work would have to be done by the SD decoders before any sense could be made of all these transmissions that have been recorded. However, they have learned enough to know that the broadcast, dating from January to February 42, revealed vital German defense secrets. Moreover, they had obviously been intended for Moscow, since they would provide a detailed intelligence concerning German troop movements on the Eastern Front. These two discoveries, coming within a few days of one another, both delighted and disturbed Schellenberg. This was confirmed by his statements to the British after the war. Reinhard Heydrich had been right. When these messages had been decoded, they had confirmed Heydrich's initial suspicions when the military security had first shown him the documents and had been captured from the Russians. The Wehrmacht was obviously being undermined from within. No one but the German officers would be able to communicate intelligence of such extraordinary value to the Russians. They must have set up an espionage cell among the officer corps, a cell totally independent of the usual networks that had been regularly unmasked by the SD since the discovery of the most important of them, Die Rote Kapelle. This network had been assisted by two German officers, Becker, a brilliant colonel, and Schulz-Boysen, a lieutenant colonel in the Luftwaffe, in getting military intelligence. Schellenberg had a vague feeling that something was wrong with his analysis of the situation. If this espionage cell in the Wehrmacht existed, why had the Russians concealed its radio operator in Switzerland? He knew only too well how difficult it was to cross Swiss frontiers. New precautions had constantly been taken to smuggle his own spies into the Confederation. Yet there seemed no other way but for the agents of this supposed cell to transmit their news to their technician in Switzerland than by radio, especially as the transmissions from Switzerland between January and February 42 had been almost daily. But if they possessed a transmitter to send their intelligence to their men in Switzerland, why did they not send it directly to Moscow, as Die Rote Kapelle had done? It struck Schellenberg that there could only be one answer to this torrent of questions nagging him. The Swiss had something to do with this affair. They might even be accomplices. The Swiss might well be performing an incredibly dexterous balancing act. If they were as clever as in this field as they had been in organizing their supplies in advance of the war, while Europe was wearing wooden shoes and clothes made of cellulose and staple fiber, Swiss shops were full of articles made from pure wool and pure cotton, not to mention the delicatessen and the pure wheat bread. Who could tell what ingenuity they would be capable of to preserve their sacrosanct neutrality? But the Führer was making plans to put an end to all that, plans that so far had not been given a launching date. He was thinking of incorporating the German-speaking part of Switzerland and the largest and richest part of the country into his empire. For a long time, Schellenberg had been building up a remarkable espionage organization, which at the right moment could play a considerable part in the overthrowing of the Confederation in Switzerland. And now this affair had revealed an unsuspecting side to that country. Something had to be done. He must find out what was going on in the heads of the Swiss leaders. To do so, he would have to exercise his customary patience and diplomacy to create an atmosphere of trust. And that's it for today. We'll start up with chapter 11 on a future date. Well, that sudden burst of energy the Third Reich got breaking through here and there would never have been enough, because once the United States and Australia and Canada and all of those were in there, they had inexhaustible sources of raw material. Now, if Hitler would have got a hold of the oil fields, that would have made a big impact for sure. But over the long haul, I don't think it would still have saved him. One thing that was quite surprising is that it was general knowledge that there was a spy ring, and a lot of the people in the officer corps knew who they were, which is incredible. I mean, it's amazing. It's hard to understand why there wasn't a crash, absolute top-to-bottom crash to get these guys out. And as I say all the time, 14-5 and shut up.